Blog Talk Radio.
Terrorists were planning to blow up bridges or tunnels on the anniversary of 9/11
turned into a police state showcase and ended in a farce when fight adjusts were scrambled as a response to people visiting airplane bathrooms.
Following days of endless fear-mongering, prompted by a reliable source who provided uncorroborated information that the Al-Qaeda was planning to strike this weekend, we were saturated with images of police brazenly violating the Fourth Amendment by conducting sweeping vehicles and badge searches, National Guard troops with guns, and random checkpoints, all serving as a reminder that terrorists really did win. We all saw that on the news and everywhere. But what became of the deadly terror plot? Was the attempt foiled by the suffocating but necessary security procedures? Fighter planes were scrambled, bomb squads were called, FBI command centers were on alert, and police teams raced to airports today, but in the end, two separate airline incidents were caused by apparently innocent bathroom breaks and a little making out, federal officials said. F-16 fighter jets were scrambled to follow a Frontier airline flight from Denver to Detroit after reports that three passengers, two men and a woman, were acting suspiciously and spending lengthy amounts of time in the bathroom. After landing in Detroit, police stormed the plane with guns drawn and ordered everybody to put their heads down and their hands on the seat in front of them. The police even said everyone remain seated. If you get out of your seats, you will be taken care of quickly, said Marlon Dietrich. Passengers were then ordered off the plane without their belongings and forced to undergo FBI searching while bomb-sniffing dogs searched their luggage. No one was hurt. No one has been placed under arrest. All the detained passengers, including the two who were first taken off the plane, have been released, reported ABC.
It turned out that the suspicious behavior was two people making out in the bathroom mid-flight, law enforcement sources told ABC. In another incident, two fighter jets were scrambled to escort an American Airlines jet into New York, JFK's airport. Again, the suspicious behavior that prompted the alert comprised of passengers visiting the restroom. So the serious and sober terror alert that provoked thousands of headlines and a multi-million dollar security response, while, of course, presenting the perfect opportunity to reinforce the police state by involving 9/11, culminated in nothing more than a mighty freakout in response to a few people eager to use the bathroom. The whole farce underscores the fact that terrorists have won. The goal of terror is to fundamentally change society so that the population alters their behavior and willingly relinquishes their freedom through fear. By exploiting the threat of terrorism to provoke fear, the federal government has achieved this objective. The fact that Americans are more likely to die from intestinal illness, accidents causing deer, and allergic reactions to peanuts than they are in a terrorist attack is buried amidst all the panic and hand-wringing about deadly plots that never come to fruition, but do serve to justify the bloated homeland security state that has swallowed up America in the drive for profit and control. This is why the military-industrial complex publications like National Defense have openly expressed the need to maintain fear and an unrealistic American perception of risk regarding terrorist attacks in order to drive up profits. This can only be accomplished with the complicity of the establishment media, who are certain to hype more dubious terror alerts, which former DHS head Tom Ridge admitted were faked and exaggerated for political purposes in order to generate the kind of hysteria that leads to visits to the bathroom being characterized as suspicious and terror-related.
That's absolutely amazing, isn't it, folks?
Yeah.
It's just totally.
And what's
absolute.
That little audio there?
Yeah, this is ABC News.
Surface Encounters is the home of half-off granite. Beautiful granite countertops for only
I hate to listen to commercials. They throw in commercials all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not worth it. So I just go back. So I just want everyone to know that one. And, okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is that was actually, I just wanted to
I mean, that was ridiculous. I felt it was just a crackdown on anybody who was protesting the official story of 9/11.
Yeah.
And that was a perfect excuse to crack down on any demonstrators on that day and that weekend.
Absolutely.
And we've heard nothing about that. If people were arrested.
Oh, no, the people were arrested, but then they were let go.
Yeah.
You know, and
we haven't heard much about from the people who were arrested. That's what I meant. I wondered what.
That's absolutely absurd. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just great. Let's mess that one up.
Hey,
on, folks. Yeah, I'm coming. Oh, Lord, help me. Oh, we got that. Okay, I'm all set. Okay. This is a. There was another one that I'm going to play a little later. Actual interview with Winona LaDuke.
Oh, good.
All right, on her latest book, and I thought it was fascinating. But here we go. Let's see. Here's an interesting little thing. Bob Tuscan, I don't know who he is, but 9/11 Inquiry co-chair. Senator Bob Graham, 9/11. Yeah, Bob Tuscan confronts 9/11 co-chair, Senator, what's his face?
Bob Graham. Okay,
yeah.
Turn
that on. It's a couple minutes here, hang on.
Hey, Senator Graham, we talked about Building 7. Did you watch the class of that?
No question.
Yeah, no, we went through this before.
We did. You didn't like the clock.
I just don't think there's any.
What about the fact that anthrax was developed by the military?
It was not developed by the military.
The one in the strand we found wasn't developed by the military.
For the 10th anniversary of September 11, 2001, Senator Bob Graham and former governor of the state of Florida decided to have an event taking a look at the inevitable biological attack and whether or not we're prepared. In an interview in which Graham, who was the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee on and after September 11, 2001, said Osama bin Laden, the al-Qaeda terrorist leader and the mastermind of the attacks, wanted subsequent attacks to outdo the death toll of nearly 3,000 that day. Graham said that would be difficult to do with conventional weapons. Turning the intelligence community's attention to biological terrorism like the spread of anthrax. Well, when we got up with his counterpart for this event, Dr. Glenn Morris, the director of UF's Emerging Pathogens Institute, which studies viruses that can infect plants and animals, he actually acknowledged the fact that the specific strand came from our military.
Dr. Morris, I have a quick question about the anthrax, which was found shortly after 9/11. It turns out that they tested the strand of anthrax, and it's the same strand that was developed by a certain black ops in our military. Are you familiar with that?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yes.
The person you were just in the panel with told us it was.
Anthrax is a naturally recurring substance from dead bovines, primarily.
That's misinformation, sir. That's not actual fact.
The word anthrax means Siberian world. That's where they first came.
Don't touch him. That's insult.
I know you're not getting on that one.
Free fall speed, sir. How can a 47-story building fall in at free fall speed in less than 6 seconds? Hey, don't touch him. That's assault, sir.
Saying that it's not Pentagon, and the expert just said, yeah, it was. So, anyway, here's another really interesting one. E-Verify flags Obama's Social Security number as fraudulent. Right? Yeah, this is funny. Barack Obama's mysterious Connecticut-based Social Security number does not pass E-Verify. Now, we even have a copy of the affidavit signed by the private citizen who entered Obama's Social Security number in the self-check section of the E-Verify website, only to find that Obama's Social Security number flagged as likely being fraudulent. And this is the...
as you are probably aware, E-Verify is the electronic system created by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to verify if prospective employees have the required authorization to work legally in the United States.
I find it fascinating. Hang on a second. We're going to go to this.
Just makes you speculate about more about him.
Absolutely. And, again, his birth certificate. But, and this is from Minuteman PAC in defense of our sovereign leader.
Recently we brought it to your attention that Barack Obama was issued a Social Security number set aside for applicants in Connecticut, though there is no record here he ever lived or even had a mailing address in the state. And let's not forget, Barack Obama's Social Security number was issued between 1977 and 1979. Yet Obama's earliest employment reportedly was in 1975 at an ice cream shop in Hawaii. Now, following the story of Obama's Social Security number into the E-Verify self-check, the system indicated Obama's Social Security number produced a mismatch that warranted a visit to the Social Security Administration to investigate the discrepancy.
A closer look at the flag shows the check reason for the mismatch notice. It says SSA record does not verify. Other reason, Social Security Agency found a discrepancy in the record. After further investigation, we found that the response is to be interpreted as special indicator present. As of August 2008, there were 9 special indicator codes, 8 of which are related to fraud, false identity, non-citizenship, not in status, multiple Social Security numbers with different identities, scrambled earnings with new Social Security number assigned, Social Security number obtained using fraudulent documentation, Social Security assignment based on harassment, abuse, life endangerment, fictitious identity, fraud, fraud Social Security number misuse. Our request for further information from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security remain unanswered. Barack Obama's Social Security number has failed the Social Security Administration's verification system, even though it is in active use, listed on his Selective Service Registration and used to file his 2009 federal tax return.
Huh.
And so the plot thickens. And the E-Verify system has recently gained notoriety in the past few years because of its ability to determine if prospective employees are illegal immigrants and therefore eligible or ineligible to work in the United States and fill jobs intended for U.S. citizens and legal residents. There has been a push by conservatives in Washington to mandate that all employers use E-Verify, but so far it has been slow going on Capitol Hill. But we're here to change that. With the jobs numbers getting worse by the minute and Obama forcing amnesty down our throats, we need your help. Here at Minuteman PAC, or Minuteman PAC, we're rallying our fellow patriots across America to demand a congressional investigation of the E-Verify's inability to confirm Obama's Social Security number and demand the E-Verify mandate. After all, we U.S. citizens employ the President of the United States, don't we? For America, Minuteman PAC. And it's amazing. It's totally amazing. As it exists, you go to this Minuteman PAC and check it out. It's It just totally freaked me out. This one here, France had a problem. A nuclear chain reaction may have caused an explosion at France Mox plant. Okay. And France's 85% of France's power is by
nuclear
power.
Yeah, I knew it was quite hot.
The accident is probably due to a few violent chemical reactions at France's SORN, Europe 1 of the French Nuclear Energy Society. It can only be an explosion due to the criticality that it is to say that at one point there is a nuclear reaction, a chain reaction that begins but cannot last. It is very low enough to make an explosion. You can tell these French the way he talks. But this is the first time it appears to us in 15 years, said one of Europe's heads of occupational medicine. Do not panic. We keep them informed, but for now, we were just asked to lock themselves in the building and not to leave. So these are people that have been exposed to this. So.
Yeah.
In the buildings.
Poor people.
Hang on a second here. Let's see what we got. This is from Intel Hub.
Oh boy, the printing is small.
Yeah, I can kind of read this. The accident, I just read that. Okay. An investigation will be opened in order to determine the exact cause of the accident. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has asked France for information about the explosion. The crisis center of the UN agency was immediately activated. So that's the whole article, but interesting, no? I thought. This one was horrible.
A 14-year-old boy got into a fight at a school.
And the police officer shot him dead.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And this is from Courthouse News Service, San Antonio, CN. Where's CN?
I don't know. I would have thought San Antonio would be in Texas. It doesn't look like San Antonio, Texas, I thought. But it is CN. It says
CN, but I don't know what that means.
Courthouse News,
okay.
That's
San Antonio is Texas, yeah.
A
14-year-old boy got into a fight at a school bus stop, and a school district's police officer responded by shooting him to death.
Oh, my God.
The boy's mother says, she says the cop had been reprimanded 16 times in the previous 4 years, suspended without pay 5 times, and recommended for termination for insubordination. But the school kept him on the force without remedial training.
Oh, my God.
Denise Lopez Moreno sued the Northside Independent School District of San Antonio, the district's chief of police, John Page, and the alleged shooter, Daniel Alvarado, in federal court. Lopez says her son, Derek, got in a fight with another boy at the school bus and punched the other boy once in November 2010. Defendant Alvarado, having responded to a call regarding a bus with a flat tire, witnessed Derek strike the other boy. He ordered Derek to freeze. Derek hesitated and then ran from defendant Alvarado, according to the complaint. In his patrol car, Alvarado began chasing Derek in a neighborhood across the street from the high school. Alvarado lost sight of the boy in the neighborhood and returned to the location of the school boy fight. At that time, he called dispatch. Dispatch recording reflect that his superior directed Alvarado to stay with the other boy and to not do any big search over there. Ignoring his supervisor's orders to stay with the victim and get the information from him, Alvarado placed the second boy into the patrol car and sped onto the neighborhood to search for Derek. Lopez says her son jumped over a fence and hid in a shed in the backyard of a house. The homeowner saw him, called 911 and alerted neighborhood, who pointed Alvarado in Derek's direction. Lopez says her son never left the shed, never approached the house or threatened the homeowner or her daughter, and posed no threat to anyone. Nonetheless, she says, in violation of NISD, police department procedures, Alvarado drew his weapon immediately after exiting the patrol car. With his gun drawn, he rushed through the gate into the backyard. Within seconds from arriving at the residence, Alvarado shot and killed the unarmed boy hiding in the shed.
Nice.
A neighbor who is an EMT called an ambulance, which arrived in 20 minutes, during which time the EMT was trying to save Derek's life. His mom says But she says her son died in the ambulance about 50 minutes after Alvarado shot him. Lopez says the directed act. Lopez says the district acted with a deliberate indifference in keeping Alvarado on the force despite his poor disciplinary record. In approximately a four-year period leading up to the shooting, defendant Alvarado had been reprimanded 16 times, the complaint states. And specifically, he had been reprimanded for insubordination, failure to follow supervisor directives 7 times. And due to his poor service record, Alvarado was suspended without pay on 5 occasions. On May 21st, 2008, Alvarado was recommended for termination by Page. Despite being recommended for termination for insubordination and for refusing to follow supervisor directives, Alvarado remained on the force without remedial training. And rather than fire Alvarado, the district preferred him to patrol, transferred him to patrol, an area of duty with less supervision.
According to the complaint, Lopez claims the district, which has about 70 police officers, failed to train its officers on procedures regarding off-campus criminal activity, use of weapons, use of force, and communication with other law enforcement agencies. Even after the tragedy of November 12, 2010, Lopez says NISD has not trained its officers on its procedures relating to actions officers should take when witnessing an offense occurring off campus. She seeks punitive damages for civil rights violations, supervisory liability, and negligence. She is represented by Wallace Rylack.
I hope she wins.
Well, she deserves to.
I hope she wins. What a jerk. Another reason I don't like Texas. I mean, I like Texas, but I don't like its government.
Man arrested at Ground Zero for demanding the truth. That should be interesting.
Why don't we check this one out? This is a little audio portion.
September 11th, 2011. Ground Zero at Church and Vesey Street. The propaganda event was over, and I was compelled to speak out about my feelings and observations, both to share them publicly and also to raise a question. Can there ever be healing, tribute, and proper respect given to the 9/11 victims without first telling the truth about what happened there? This is what happens to you in freedom-loving America when you exercise your First Amendment rights.
Everybody's got a couple of smug guys. Come on.
A heated discussion ensued. While one officer agreed that 9/11 was indeed an inside job and that I was not dangerous, another rookie there kept telling me to stop. Stop what? I said. I'm not doing anything illegal. What he wanted for me to do was to stop telling him the truth. Stop killing his comfort zone. He wanted me to stop questioning, stop seeking justice for 9/11, because all this implies that he, too, is morally bound, like I am, to act on the truth. All in all, though the officers were fundamentally wrong about the eventual disorderly conduct charge and admitted it, they were generally respectful, except of my First Amendment right to free speech. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. It does not say anywhere in there, except during sacred 9/11 ceremonies, or except without a permit, or except under the auspices of a police state. What people like me cannot fathom, however, is how one can know the truth and simultaneously repress it by just following orders. The NYPD and the New York Fire Department both know that their people died that day because the towers were blown up, not because they collapsed by the airplane impacts.
And they're all there lined up promoting the lies.
Yeah, you can't respect them and promote lies about 9/11 at the same time.
He's absolutely right, I agree.
Before the day was done, I spoke to about 10 officers about 9/11 truth. All of them were deeply interested in knowing more about the science of 9/11. In the end, even the rookie who booked me apologized and had learned something very important, that not even he was truly safe until 9/11 is properly investigated.
There are victories of the soul and spirit. Sometimes even if you lose, you win. Ellie was well. So, let me, okay. And I wanted to, there's a couple other great things here I wanted to talk about. Another article is, prepare to be assaulted. This government is out of control. It's from the Twilight Zone, davidicke.com. The U.S. Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, TSA, the FDA, the CIA, renditions, assassinations, multiple and continuous wars, torture, bailout, inflation, false flag events, secrecy, illegal searches, spying on citizens, private property, confiscations, and much, much more is now commonplace. It is now considered to be a crime to grow your own food, to film the police, to sell lemonade on the street corner, or to protest, and in many cases just to speak out against the state. It is no coincidence that I am writing this on the celebrated anniversary of 9/11, as the hoopla over this weekend has enough to cause nausea to most any libertarian or any critical thinker. The planned event unfolding are nothing shy of nonsense and propaganda, but they do serve a purpose. That purpose, of course, is to continue to advance nationalism and state worship. Wherever one looks, every television channel, every sporting event, every parade, the talking heads will be spewing lies and waving flags. And the remembrance of that day will be evangelical in nature. It will be a banner day for politicians, and they will unabashedly practice false patriotism and swim in a cesspool of self-interest. There's a little more to this article, and I want to read it. But definitely true. This is by LouRockwell.com, written by Gary Barnett. War will be celebrated, and continued war will be justified. Every event of this nature serves to promote more killing than anything else, and never serves as a time to question as it rightly should. Tempers will flare and hatred will reign among the masses, while the innocent people in war-torn countries in the Middle East, now being destroyed by the U.S. government and its minions and the military, will continue to live in fear. Live in fear they must, as the unholy prosecution of unjust war by the largest imperial force on earth is upon them. It's not only those people with darker skin and different religious beliefs in the Middle East that should fear this beast. We all should be wary. The rules of empire and their accomplices and their crime are never satisfied and are never complacent. Their brutality and lust for power and money only grows in each and every aggression. That aggression has now come home to roost in the form of intimidation, regulation, police brutality, and a nearly complete destruction of liberty. And the economy is failing, and the coming total police state seems closer at hand than ever before. In other words, prepare to be assaulted. Those of us unwilling to accept this assault will be targeted. While those willing to bow down to authority will lose any chance to be free men. At this time, the masses fall into the latter group and will continue to do as they are told. I hope that this apathetic behavior has a transformation of some magnitude before it's too late. After an economic collapse, the risk of massive civil unrest increases and the danger of martial law and increased police and military involvement in domestic affairs becomes almost imminent. If allowed to escalate to that level, it will be increasingly difficult to turn the tide, and at that point, any peaceful solution will be rendered ineffective. Since only peaceful means should be used to destroy the power of government, waiting until state forces are patrolling the streets is not a viable option. Acting in advance of any economic or political cataclysm is the proper course of action. Take heed of the coming reign of authoritarianism. While tyrannical behavior by this government is already evident, it can take much worse. It can get much worse. We are not far away from patrolling drones watching our every move, if in fact that is not already a policy in place or being planned. We are not far away from the economic collapse due to government and Federal Reserve policies, and we are not far away from global war. And as this government continues to spiral out of control, these things become more possible and more probable. We simply cannot wait any longer to stop this assault, and we must spread discontent. The most dangerous man in any government is the man who is able to think things out for himself without regard to the prevailing superstitions and taboos. And almost inevitably, he comes to the conclusion that the government he lives under is dishonest, insane, and intolerable. And so if he is romantic, he tries to change it. And even if he is not romantic, personally he is apt to spread discontent among those who are. That was written by H.L. Mencken. And that was by Gary Barnett. You can go to lourockwell.com and check that out. Very good. I wanted to... I was really disturbed when I read this. As I am by all these vaccines, you know, being pushed on people, especially when they're not really proven to be useful. But vaccines given to toddlers is really, really frightening to me. And this article states that meningitis vaccines are now pushed onto 9-month-old toddlers. Another potentially hazardous vaccine, Menectra, purportedly protecting against an extremely rare disease, meningitis, has been FDA approved for children ages 9 to 23 months. This brings the total vaccine inoculation schedule to over 20 within the child's first 2 years, and there are more to come by age 5 and more than that, more after that. And this is frightening, absolutely frightening. And you know that the FDA could actually do this to us, to our children. Oh God, this is by naturalnews.com. Vaccine benefits are questionable. Most of the childhood diseases supposedly protected by vaccinations come and go without significant damage. Many graphs have demonstrated that serious diseases had already declined naturally and all but disappeared by the time the vaccines for them had been introduced. As a matter of fact, exposure to many minor childhood diseases causes better long-term immunization than vaccines pretend to offer. There have been actual reports of 90% plus measles, mumps, and rubella vaccinated populations having breakouts with mumps and measles. Rubella hardly happens at all. The more dangerous diseases vaccinated against hardly ever even occur. So the benefit factor is very low in populations with decent hygiene. Vaccine risks are real. What has been occurring is a surge among the very young with vaccine injury-related deaths, as in SIDS, which is sudden infant death syndrome, of various forms of paralysis, disabling seizures, autism spectrum, behavior often with extreme bowel disorders, ADHD, asthma, and food allergies. The kids are worse off now than before. And most of these alarming events have occurred shortly after vaccinations, especially after a barrage of multiple shots in one day or within the same time frame as the scheduled series. The fact that cancer and other autoimmune disorders manifest later in life is not included in this vaccine injury summary. But along with increased vaccination schedules, there has been a decline in general health. Cancer cases among the young have increased considerably over the last 2 to 3 decades, coinciding with increased vaccination schedules. Impurities occur often in vaccines, especially those derived from animal tissues or human fetuses. Then there are the preservatives that include mercury, formaldehyde, and aluminum. Some vaccines may contain ingredients or adjuvants to boost the vaccine's potency. One such adjuvant, squalene, is linked to Gulf War syndrome. A Japanese researcher has found mercury in all cancer cells, and mercury is a neurotoxin supreme. The U.S. National Institute of Health has recently stated that formaldehyde causes cancer. Aluminum is able to cross the blood-brain barrier and cause neurological damage, and brain-damaging aspartame is used in some vaccines. Imagine that. Aspartame is used in some vaccines. And several internet sites have been started and maintained by parents whose children have been seriously vaccine damaged. They share their tragic personal stories that are hidden from public view and ignored or scoffed at by pediatricians and other medical professionals. Do some research. You can start by clicking vaccines in the hot topic bar at the top of the Natural News homepage, or look into the sources below. And just check out Natural News for these articles. It's amazing. So anyway, let's go beyond that. I have a video tonight, or an audio, I should say. I keep saying that because it's what it is. War profiteers escalate their war on jobs. This is just a short one. Let's go to this, and then I have another by Winona LaDuke, and excellent video, excellent interview.
War contracting doesn't make us safer, but it does make a few corporations and CEOs very rich, at the expense of the rest of us. Right now, the new deficit committee is meeting to cut federal spending, but not all spending is equal when it comes to creating jobs. Some corporations get very rich off military contracts. That's why they've hired 843 lobbyists and recently spent $210 million to influence Congress to protect their profits. These corporations just set up a new front group called Second to None to pressure the Deficit Committee to protect war industry profits and war profiteers. But the Political Economy Research Institute reports that war spending costs jobs compared to other types of spending. This year's Afghanistan war spending costs more than 352,000 jobs. That's one small slice of the huge war budget. But Second to None's backers want the Deficit Committee to think the opposite. These corporations spread their operations across the country to make it harder politically to cut war contracts. But more people would have jobs if we cut war spending and use that money in other ways. The Deficit Committee now must choose between protecting millions of people who need jobs and protecting war industry revenues. The companies behind Second to None are working hard to manipulate the committee. They've already given more than $1 million to committee members' PACs and campaigns. Now they're marching to the Hill to cash in on these donations and protect their profits. The War Cost Campaign is fighting back, but we need your help. Call Deficit Committee co-chairs Hensarling and Murray and tell them you want real cuts to the war budget so we can put America back to work.
In this thing, they just stated that Clyburn, I don't know if you recall, I think he's the head of the Black Caucus, just got $310,000 from these bastards. And he's on the committee, on the Deficit Committee. So, interesting, no? I'm going to, I apologize, Lila's not with us right now, but she just had a visitor, and I wanted to go to this article. She's back.
I'm back.
She's back.
I just had somebody at my door. I had to go.
Yeah. And,
sorry,
but I wanted to play. This is about 14 minutes long.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this. I haven't heard it either.
This is Winona LaDuke on the militarization of Indian country and Obama's administration lip service to indigenous rights.
Which he promised to uphold.
That's right, but he's doing absolutely nothing to do anything with about it. And she talks about this and the hypocrisy of and the complete genocide.
Winona, you begin your book on the militarization of Native America at Fort Sill, the U.S. Army post near Lawton, Oklahoma. We broadcast from there about a year ago in that area. Why Fort Sill? What is the significance of Fort Sill for Native America?
Well, you know, that is where the Apaches themselves were incarcerated for 27 years for the crime of being Apache. There are two cemeteries there, and those cemeteries, one of those cemeteries is full of Apaches, including, you know, Geronimo, who did die there. But it is emblematic of Indian country's domination by military bases and the military itself. You've got over 17 reservations named after, they're still called Fort something, you know. Fort Hall is, you know, one of them, Fort Yates. You know, it is pervasive, the military domination of Indian country. Most of the land takings that have occurred for the military, whether in Alaska, in Hawaii, or in what is known as the continental United States, have been takings from native land. Some of the, you know, they say that the Lakota Nation, in the Lakota Nation's traditional territory, as guaranteed under the Treaty of 1868 or the 1851 Treaty, would be the third greatest nuclear power in the world. You know, those considerations indicate how pervasive historically the military has been to in Native history and remains today in terms of land occupation. I must say, on the other side of that, we have the highest rate of living veterans of any community in the country. It's estimated that about 22% of our population, or 190,000 of our 190,000, there are 190,000 living veterans in Native America today. And all of those veterans, I am sure, are quite offended by the use of Geronimo's name, you know, in the assault on Bin Laden and in the death of Bin Laden.
Well, in your book, you go through a lot of these takings of land and what it's been used for. Obviously, the nuclear accident following the tsunami in Japan has been in the news a lot lately. But you talk about the origins of the United States' own nuclear power, the mining of uranium, the development of Los Alamos Laboratory. Could you talk about that and its connection to Indian country?
Yeah, you know, Native people, about 2/3 of the uranium in the United States is on indigenous lands. On a worldwide scale, about 70% of the uranium is either in Aboriginal lands in Australia or up in the subarctic of Canada, where Native people are still fighting uranium mining. And now with both nuclearization and the potential reboot of a nuclear industry, they're trying to open uranium mines on the sacred Grand Canyon. You know, we have been from the beginning heavily impacted by radiation exposure from the U.S. military. You know, continuing on to nuclear testing, whether in the Pacific or whether the 1,100 nuclear weapons that were detonated over Western Shoshone territory. You know, our peoples have been heavily, impacted by radiation, let alone nerve gas testing. You've got nerve gas dumps at Umatilla. You've got a nerve gas dump at the Skull Valley Goshute Reservation. You have, you know, weapons bases, and the military is the largest polluter in the world. And a lot of that pollution in what is known as the United States, or some of us would refer to as occupied Indian country, is in fact all, heavily impacting Indian people or indigenous communities still.
You also talk about the radiation experimentation in Alaska in the 1960s in your book. I don't think very few people have heard of that. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I remember I researched all this really bizarre data, but there was this project at Point Hope where the military wanted to look at the radiation lichen caribou man cycle of bioaccumulation of radiation. And so they went into the Arctic. You know, there's widespread testing on Native people. A couple of isolated populations were basically, you know, most of us in that era were genetically pretty similar. It was a good test population, and there was no accountability. You know, testing has occurred, you know, widespread. But in that, they wanted to test, so the village of Point Hope was basically irradiated. Didn't tell the people. Documents were declassified in the 1990s. And all that time, this community bore a burden of nuclear exposure that came from the Nevada test site, and in testing those communities. You know, Alaska itself is full of nuclear and toxic waste dumps from the military, over 700 separate, including, you know, perhaps one of the least known, but I did talk about it in this book, The Militarization of Indian Country, VX Lake, where they happened to forget about some nerve gas canisters, a whole bunch of them, and they put them out in the middle of the lake, and they sank to the bottom, and then they remembered a few years later, and then they had to drain the darn lake to go get all these, all the nerve gas, the VX, out of the bottom of the lake. And, they renamed it Blueberry Lake, but it's still known as VX Lake to anybody who's up there. And, the unaccountability of the military, above reproach, having such a huge impact on a worldwide scale, having such a huge take at the federal trough, the federal budget, and in indigenous communities, an absolutely huge impact in terms of the environmental consequences of militarization.
We're talking to Winona LaDuc, Native American activist, writer. Her latest book is called The Militarization of Indian Country. Winona, talk about the history of Native participation in and opposition to war, but begin with your dad, with your father.
Yeah, I wrote this book out of a debt, you know, really to my father. My father was a Korean War resistor, and he spent 11 months in prison for refusing to fight a war that he did not believe was his. There is a long history of Native people, whether the Zunis, whether the Hopis, whether the Iroquois, whether the Ojibways, who said, you know, that's really not our war. We're staying here. The United States, people you know, one of the reasons that it is said that Native people received citizenship in 1924 was so that they could be drafted, and they have been extensively drafted, you know, for a whole variety of social, political, historic, cultural, and economic reasons. Native people have the highest rate of enlistment in this country, you know, from historic to present, you know, in some places, you know, in our Indian communities, you know, you have very dire economic situations, and the military recruiters are very aggressive, and young people do not have a lot of choices. I mean, you know, I had young men from my community say, you know, Auntie, I joined the military. I said, why did you join the military? He says, because I was either going to jail or going to the military. You know, and I have heard that story more than once in Indian country. So, you know, having said that, you have a history of warrior societies, of people who are proud, who have defended our land. You know, 500 years is a long time to defend your territory. And, you know, we're still here. And within that, you know, our warrior societies continue, you know, whether it is at Oka, whether it was at Wounded Knee, whether it is on the front lines of the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, or whether it is in the Grand Canyon defending our territory. At the same time, you have a number, you know, a large rate of enlistment. And so, you know, you have Native veterans who are in our community highly regarded for who they are as courageous individuals, you know, and a very significant part of our communities. At the same time, there is no program to reintegrate these individuals into our society. A lot of, you know, the highest rate of homelessness is in veterans in this country. And, you know, many other issues of PTSD and such exist widespread in our communities because of our isolation and our high rates of enlistment and our high rates of veterans.
When Alaladuk, you also talk, when talking about Fort Sill, about the Comanche people asking for Fort Sill not to destroy Medicine Bluff. Can you talk about these sacred places in the United States, starting with Fort Sill? Where are they threatened, and how do you preserve these lands?
Well, you know, the military is, you know, the U.S. government's the largest landowner. The United States, you know, Native people are large landowners, but the military has a huge chunk of our territories. And in those, there are a number of places that are our sacred sites. You know, perhaps the best examples are really in Hawaii, where, you know, the military took the island of Koho'olawe, an entire island, to turn it into a bombing range for 40 years. You know, that is my first politicization, I would say, as to the impact of the military, you know, in indigenous communities. Took a whole island, and then, you know, eventually the island is now returned. The aquifer is cracked from bombing. And, you know, it is it's unconscionable, the practice. Today, Hawaii, you see the continuation of the expansion of military holdings there. Ohakaloa is an expansion for the Striker that they're looking at on the big island of Hawaii to take another, 79,000 acres of land. There's only so much land on an island full of sacred sites, full of historic sites, that Hawaiians and Native Hawaiians and all people have a right to visit, but now is becoming a part of a military base. And increasing land takings, particularly in Hawaii, is one of the worst cases.
And, Winona, as we mentioned earlier, you were a vice presidential candidate twice on the ticket, an independent ticket with Ralph Nader. And as you see now in these years of the last few years of the Obama administration, do you see any significant change in the way that the Native American nations across the country have been treated under the Obama administration?
You know, I would say that things are better. I would say we've got a few egregious problems still. You know, you have, for instance, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. As you likely know, there were four holdout countries as of 2007 that did not sign on. U.S. and Canada are the only two countries that have yet to sign on the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Obama administration made some lip service to it, posturing. I was thinking maybe we're in, like, some kind of yoga position on it. I don't know what posture he's in, but we'd like to see that, you know, carried out. As well, you know, apology. You know, that these are in many ways symbolic gestures. There was an apology to Native peoples that was issued, but no one heard it. So it's kind of like saying, you know, I'm sorry to a wall. Probably should have a little formal apology. But then there is the reality of that things in Indian country are not getting better. You can't keep putting money in the federal budget for the military and robbing everything else so that, you know, people on my reservation and other reservations don't have housing, you know, don't have education money, don't have health service, you know, don't have, you know, basic rights. And the only way, in the Native community, really, to get economically ahead in many cases is to become a military contractor. I don't know if you noticed, in the book, that it turns out that Blackwater is a Native American contractor. Now, I didn't know that, you know, and I really hadn't thought of them as a Native American contractor. But with the Chiniga Native Corporation, they've got about $1.9 billion in federal contracts that they received. You know, most of those as a sole source, non-bid contractor, because they went under the shell of an Alaska Native Corporation, the Chiniga Corporation. And so, you know, Native communities are becoming military contractors because that's where the money is. You know, so the irony of the whole history of colonization, military colonization, you know, valiant patriots like Geronimo, you know, fighting against, you know, the U.S. taking of our lands, the destruction of our peoples, to now a situation where the largest private army in the world is a Native American contractor, you know, and the fact that they, you know, they so egregiously abuse the name of Geronimo, and in, you know, widespread cases, you know, refer to Indian country as the territory that is to be taken by the U.S. military. You know, it is time to revisit this history.
That was Winona
Luther.
And
talking
the
about
by
the militarization of Indian country.
Yeah, and that was by...
you know, the Obama's administration's lip service to indigenous rights, and that was by Democracy Now.
Yeah, and that interview was Amy Gooden. And but I was totally fascinated, and as yeah, I know, we're past the streaming point.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to mention that I think tomorrow night there's a number of great speeches by her. I personally have filmed one of them back many years ago.
Mm-hmm. When she was running with Ralph Nader.
When she was running with Ralph Nader back in 2000. And, or 2000, yeah, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'll run another one tomorrow night. This one looks it's fascinating here.
Yep.
Right here. Thinking beyond empire, fire, and understanding what she's talking about. And, you know, it's sad. You know, I'm looking at this particular Democracy Now! One that came up, and there are only 2,000 views since May on this, and there's so many of her other ones. There's 167 views and so on. She's such an important person to listen to.
She's a very smart woman, and she has a lot to say.
And,
but you don't see her interviewed on the mainstream media. You don't see her the problems of indigenous peoples talked about at all.
That's right. And her new book is called The Militarization of Indian Country, and I really hope that that does well.
I hope it gets some attention.
Yeah. We'll definitely try to do something with that. So anyway,
we've come to the end of the show.
Yeah, but I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and we hope that you enjoyed the show.
And have a good night.
Yeah, and please join me tomorrow night when we take it a little higher to the fourth dimension. And also, I believe I may play more of Winona LaDuke's speech, because there is a truly spiritual woman, and one that should be much more recognized. So I wish everyone a good evening, and talk to you tomorrow night.